today's study, the book of the Gospel of John, chapter 4. We'll have a reading of 6 verses. Sister Esther.
When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee, and he must needs go through to Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour.
All right, now the first 2 verses. When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. Why? Why? Doesn't there seem to be a relationship to verse 3 and to verse 1? Because it says when he was apprised of this fact, of what had happened, that he then departs. Why?
Wasn't this another instance? By removing himself from the scene,
it eliminated
a premature problem.
And he knew what was in man, and need not be told, and so forth, sometimes in that sense, as well as in the unfavorable sense. Now, verse 4, he must needs go through Samaria. So now we know the route he took. That it went through what's now called Annapolis, the present day. And Sychem and other names was given in the Old Testament. All right, that's just a historical statement. And then he cometh to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Well, when did Jacob give this parcel of ground to Joseph? Yes, that would be when he would inherit it. It would be inherited then. But, of course, Jacob himself first had to purchase this parcel of ground, which he later gave to Joseph at the time of his deathbed prophecy, because Joseph got a double portion. But when you go back and read the account, you would not necessarily get the thought that this parcel of ground and such was given to him on that occasion when he was on his deathbed, but that is probably the occasion, and that there was some other conversation that took place at that time. That'd be the logical time, because when he would dispense his goods to his children, he would make known as to who got what, in more particular than the scripture. There was no necessity to go into that.
I'm not sure if I remember correctly. Was that where it was divided with Manasseh and Ephraim at that time?
Well, that's where he got the double portion, that the blessing that Jacob gave, which he pronounced orally, he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh they were the two children of Joseph. Remember, there was the switching of hands and so forth. And then he mentions in the blessing that Joseph would be like a fruitful bough that would leap over the wall and so forth. And then the implication is that that he would get a double portion compared to Judah, through whom the lawgiver was to come and the prince and so forth. So Judah got one tremendous blessing, and Joseph, though, it would seem that got sort of like an equal blessing in some respects, in that he got double more than the others. And, we could take a moment off. Why? What would it be that Joseph got, even though it was like through Ephraim and Manasseh? What did Joseph picture? Sometimes represents the church, rarely, more rarely. And
he was the firstborn of Rachel.
Yes.
Rachel.
Who died, yes. When
bringing forth eventually. But actually wasn't the firstborn, though, otherwise. Was
no, but it's unusual that in connection with this prophecy, because you had all the others, you had, see, this is the unusual part. He gets a double recognition among the tribes. Instead of there being a tribe of Joseph, it was the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, and no other brother or son of Jacob got a double portion, such as Joseph got. So it would be like giving him, as it were, the firstborn portion, where Judah was the fourthborn, and yet it gets the lawgiver. And you had Reuben was the firstborn, and so forth.
But he loved Rachel. Oh, the Lord arranged it.
All right. Well, then you see, if you draw a picture of Joseph and Rachel, then you have to consider Leah, but not bring in the children, because it'll distort the picture. So he loved Rachel more than he loved Leah, and then Leah represents one class, and Rachel represents another. But you're not considering the children. And then in that case, Joseph represents Jesus. Rachel would represent the church. But you don't consider the children aspect. See, that, because that changes. That's the problem with many pictures. They're overdrawn. You don't know where to stop. But when you're making comparisons, you have to make a little complete unit, but not go too far. Unless it becomes very obvious that it's meant to go further. And then when we do that, then we forget Leah and we go into the difference between Joseph and the difference between Benjamin, who were born with regard to it was Jacob and Rachel. Not Joseph. Yes. This had to do with Joseph, and of course would be in a prophetic sense, because you'll notice that when it came to the burial of the others, I'm not talking about Joseph, because Joseph was taken up when the Exodus took place. They brought Joseph's body and buried it in that place. But also at the same time, you have Abraham had given where he was buried were these others, Abraham and his wife, Isaac and his wife, and Jacob and his wife, Leah, but not Rachel. But I don't want to get into this because we have it won't be a study on John. But so there was a dispensing of property which he looked ahead to, made arrangements for. So it would seem to be, with regard to this other, that it's emphasizing the spiritual with Joseph, where with Judah it represents the natural lineage of Christ and possessing characteristics of Judah and so forth, but it's the coming of Jesus at his first advent that is emphasized by the lion of the tribe of Judah, that out of Judah, from the natural descent aspect, where the Joseph has to do with something along spiritual lines, which is not our topic today. Alright, now, this, of course, tells us then that parcel of ground also included a well, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that helps to identify where this is. And so in Annapolis, in the suburb, hard close to the center of town, of course now it's grown bigger in present day, but you have the well that still exists, which originally was on the side of a hill, that would be the parcel of ground with regard to Joseph. But it probably wasn't a lot of 50 by 100. You see, in those days, when you got a piece of ground, it would be considerably larger. And the tomb of Joseph, which is now in Annapolis, is fairly close to this well. Outside the territory, but just down the street a couple.
Oh, you mean that's where they brought the body from?
No, yeah.
Egypt over.
Oh, Egypt, and he was buried, and they have a spot not too far away, and it may be the right spot, and it may not.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough evidence, like with the Garden Tomb and other places, and Abraham, where he was buried. There's very historical, substantive evidence. This other is conjectural, and it could be the place in the sense that it is near enough that when it says a parcel of ground, it does not mean and I'm basing this on something else with regard to the valley elsewhere that is involved in this picture, but that's a completely different study. Now, so here it's just mentioning, giving an account of Jesus making this journey, and mentions this on the side where this well is. And then, sixth verse, now Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well. And it was about the sixth hour. Any comments?
The sixth hour, would it be noontime of the Jewish reckoning, or was it the Roman?
It's probably Roman reckoning. It's funny that with your past training that some things get fastened in the memory that it's very difficult, I find, to get rid of when you're brought up as a child. And this is one. And then we had this study a couple of weeks ago, something about the, I think it was the 10th hour with regard to. And I find that I've been wavering back and forth because there's this tugging of what you've been taught as a youth. And on many occasions I speak that John is different than all the other gospel writers in that he recognizes Roman time, not the Hebrew time, which Matthew, Mark, and Luke do, and that there should be a consistency through. But I find that I contradict myself on it, because especially on the spur of a moment study, where if you're writing something and making an article, that's another matter. You have time to really think it out. Yes?
According to the footnote in the dialogue, he believed that it was the Roman time, because it says that our Lord was weary, which is
And they must draw water at certain times, too. I don't think they go at high noon. It depends on what they were drawing it for, though. I don't know.
Well, that would be probably a logical reasoning, because in the heat of the day, it would be probably less apt to want. And those pictures were funny. That you would choose, I think, an early morning hour or an hour near a dusk, where it'd be a little cooler. But John definitely was the Roman time at the end of his gospel, because there, with regard to the crucifixion and the trial of Jesus and so forth, in order to properly harmonize it with the other three accounts, it has to be reckoned as Roman time, and then everything is in harmony. But the Catholic Church has influenced greatly the thinking along this line. Even your King James, for instance, you have a footnote somewhere where it uses the Jewish time in the margins. For instance, it'll say 4 o'clock in the afternoon, for instance, someplace. We read to John, this would be earlier. This would be in the margin. And they think of the crucifixion as 12 to 3. 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And they think of that he was on the cross at 12, but not 9. But the other accounts definitely place it that he was crucified at 9 and died, and at noon came the darkening of the heaven. And then at 3 o'clock, the ninth hour, he died. So you have a 6-hour crucifixion, but the Catholic Church has taught 3 hours. Influence Protestant scholars as well. You know, I would think they die probably right, whatever it would say. So, here, near the end of the day, let's see what else happened here. We haven't read that yet about the conversation. Can we continue?
Now, Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the 6th hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, Give me to drink. For his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria, for the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered and said unto her, If thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, Give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water.
That's enough now, because this is a long dissertation, and it would take a little too hard to retain in memory each detail. But here is a part of that discussion. And Jesus asks her, give me to drink. Now, then we see the woman's reaction. She observed that he was Jewish. She could tell, because no conversation. So there was something about his dress or behavior, or was that enough to indicate he was not a Samaritan? Give me to drink. And then she says, Well, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? She had two strikes against her. She was not only a Samaritan, she was a woman asking the question. And we're now interested in Jesus' response. Yes.
She was humble to just expose herself right then and there. She didn't know that he could read her mind, I didn't think. But she let him know that she was what she was, which was, I think, the very trait.
Well, if she knew what he was, she would know that he knew with Sheba. Because it would be obvious to both along this line. And that's why he says, well, how come you do it? When you know that I'm a woman and I'm from Samaria, how come you ask me that you are being a Jew? And he didn't know. But what you're bringing out is she didn't know how much he knew about her. That she didn't know. All right. Now, so he answers, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. Now this always startles me with regard to the profound wisdom of Jesus on the spur of the moment. Because these things are done suddenly. You know, when you say, give me to drink, that's sudden. That's a sudden response. And then to have it said, if you knew who it was that is speaking to thee, you would ask of me to drink. And I would give you to drink, but of living water. Well, to think of this on that spur of the moment, and yet there's some certain deep truths there. Pastor Russell has written an article, I think the title of it is The Gift of God, which is water. Under certain circumstances of real thirst, there's nothing better than water. If you're in the desert, dying, as it were, from thirst, there's nothing. You will drink anything. You'll drink milk or anything liquid, but it's not the same as water under that sense. So he even has a poem there written by somebody, The Gift of God and What It Means. And it's a tremendous article to read. So if you have opportunity, read that preprint article on this conversation with the Samaritan woman and the significance that water had in the life of a Bedouin, those living that type of a life, how essential it was to their well-being. So he says, if you knew, you would ask me, and I would then be in a position to give you life, living water. Notice this, like we have called attention to, that the ones that Jesus calls, that are drawn of the Father to Jesus, that they have the similar characteristic of naivety. No matter who they are, whether even we had a discussion on with regard to Nicodemus in John, who was a master in Israel, there's some things that he stated where you would, those in that position normally would be too proud to couch their language a certain way. Or like the man who ran up in the tree, Zacchaeus, who was a wealthy man in his own right. And that's evidenced by what he did later. But here, she's that way. And we see when we read more about her. Now, she's puzzled by this statement, so we must go on. Let's read 11 through 14. Next.
The woman saith unto him, Sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself, and his children, and his cattle? Jesus answered and said unto her, Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life.
All right. Now, then you haven't got a bucket, you haven't got the long rope, and this is a deep well, and you haven't got... And how is it that you would say, talk to me this way, that if you to ask of me to drink, when I don't have this equipment, you know, and this well is very deep, and are you better than? But it reminds me of a way of Nicodemus who came to Jesus, and when he started to speak with her, just like Jesus, here, speaking to the woman, that he says, how can you go back into the mother's womb? You know, it's like a sort of a childish thing, you know, in a way. You say I must be born again. Go back in the mother and be reborn. See, he's thinking along this line. Well, the woman is doing the same thing. Where's this water that you have? That's, you know, it just strikes her rather strange, like it struck Nicodemus. He was very puzzled about this spirit and about the kingdom that Jesus spoke of, with no army or anything. Like, he had no rope or the bucket here. And back there, he had no army or following in that sense. He didn't have the disposition or the aggressiveness or the following that would be comportable with the famous Messiah who was to come to deliver Israel. It didn't seem that it was harmonized. So she manifests this interest. Now, if you were in her place, and you asked the question, he asked her, give me the drink, and then she makes that comment, how is it that you asked me, being so and so and so? And he says, well, you'd ask me, I'd give you a living water. Now, the way he says this, you would think of him almost like being a philosopher. You know, it isn't natural. Whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. Whosoever drinketh the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into eternal life. So, to talk this way would be very, very, very startling. This stranger would be, it would cause wonderment to have that experience. And he would speak, of course, with assurance, with authority, because whatever Jesus spoke would be sort of a conviction, the way he would say it. Now, we have to go further. We will draw lessons later, maybe. But let's read 15 through 19.
The woman says unto him, Sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus said unto her, Go, call thy husband, and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, Thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that sayest thou truly. The woman said unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet.
Right. Well, this is just like Nicodemus took Jesus literally about this rebirth.
Yeah.
She takes him literally and pursues it because she's not conscious of another application. But she still, I think, is like drawing him on in her puzzlement. And sometimes, you know, you talk mechanically. When something is asked of you that too puzzling or complex, you say sometimes foolish things to keep the conversation going so you may get a little more of the drift of it. And but here she's saying, I would like that water so that I don't come again, and she wouldn't have the task of making this trip every day to get this water. Was an onerous task, and that would be very nice to not have to make that daily trip. Yes?
Just could you give me one comment on why she answered him in the first place like that? Is that not dumb, Samaritans and Jews?
Why she didn't what?
Draw the water when he asked. I mean, why did she go into, she's a Samaritan, did they not draw for the Jews? Or?
Well, she made this, They don't have any dealings, business dealings or anything, and the Jew would be proud, too proud to ask the Samaritan. And she would realize, though, that he had no equipment with him, and that to get that water, that we would require some extra things that he may not like have had that she could see. And she would understand the thing, but she would still think. They'd be so proud that they still wouldn't do it. Even if you're thirsty and you don't have this, they still wouldn't ask. They'd wait until somebody else came along or some other opportunity arose to get that water. And this is true with many with regard to the truth. They're so proud and so forth that they never get. They're not attracted or drawn to the truth in that sense, because you do have to, especially in the beginning, recognize that somebody else has something you don't have, and eventually to inquire further and then to receive instruction. All right, now.
Brother Frank?
Yes.
I wonder why I try to put myself back in that setting and hear Jesus saying this, and then he completely changes the subject to something else. Now, I would say, well, I can't believe in you at all. What was he trying to do? You know, completely change.
I didn't get that, I can't believe in you at all.
When someone changes, in other words, if you're talking about the living water, she was asking how to get that living water. So he completely changes the subject to something else. I would say, well, I can't believe him because he's changing the whole subject. He's not telling me how to get this water. He's going just in the opposite.
Yeah.
It's so different.
Yeah.
Well, a reprint article suggested that it was necessary for Jesus to gently correct her and make her aware that she was a sinner. Because you have to recognize that fact.
But would he do that by changing the whole subject that way?
I thought you meant to change the subject to ask about the husband.
Yes, in other words, he was changing it completely.
Well, see, that's what I was trying to ask you about,
oh.
But I didn't get your thought even
oh.
just now.
Well, maybe I wasn't explaining it.
Yeah. I didn't know which part you're referring to.
Oh, it was the husband.
Because the conversation is going back and forth.
Yeah.
I didn't know what jumped.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it's just a matter of
changing it completely.
No, he's making the truth more important than his natural thirst, and he's taking that liberty, in spite of that circumstance, to enlighten her. I think originally, when he would come to this well and then rest there, and this woman come alone, that he sensed that anything that happened in his life of any significance, he would recognize that this is God, something God's providence brought this woman to this well on this occasion. And then he viewed it from that standpoint. And then he said, give me the drink. So what, he was weary and he probably was thirsty, but used this as an opportunity to introduce her to the truth, because he recognized this as providence, because this was opposite, like you say, not only in this occasion, but to his own instruction. Don't forget, this is early in his ministry.
Mm.
And early in his ministry, he says, go not into the way of the Samaritan, and enter not, and so forth. He prohibited his disciples, under certain circumstances, particularly up in Galilee. Here he's going to return. This is early in his ministry. He was down in Judea, and now he heard about John the Baptist, and he's going up to Galilee, where he stays a long time up there.
I was thinking that maybe he changed. In other words, there's two sides to this story, as I think of someone coming into the truth. Because probably she couldn't understand what he was saying, so he changed the subject. And then say we have someone newly coming in the truth, and sometimes you say something that you feel is you said the wrong thing, which I've done, you know, like in a in a study, they'll say, just for instance, the covenant. I mean, maybe they can't understand what they are. They're too much for them. I don't know whether you're following me or not.
I'm following you. The
I'm
only thing is, we are imperfect, where Jesus is perfect.
Yes, I know. But, I mean, is there a lesson in this for us in presenting other things to others? This, I guess, would be...
Well, I would think that the lesson would be, when we continue a little further, because we're not through the incident yet, that the psychology would be that you do something to whet somebody's appetite, but you don't, you then approach them on from a standpoint that they do understand. And then this aspect about the husbands and so forth is then changing the conversation to something that will help them to understand what this other matter is about this living water. She would begin to realize he was speaking allegorically or spiritually, that this water was not a literal water, but not initially, that she didn't know that. But there was something else. I was wanting to get back to this other thing. So he gives this advice, which is different than he gave his disciples, but there's a different circumstance here. He did not go into the city. He did not go to the woman. The woman came to her, and which is a different slant. And so there are rare occasions in life where a policy that we might thoroughly endorse ourselves and give advice to others along a certain line, where you differ with that on certain peculiar occasions, and this is one of them. And there was one other with the woman from that begged of the crumbs from the master's table. Now, he was not ready to give her, you know, the truth and so forth at that time, but she insisted. And he recognized this, that this is an exception to the rule. So this woman is an exception to a general rule, and he recognized. So I would say that he was in such communion with the Heavenly Father that he viewed that his ministry being so short, about 3.5 years, that he had a lot to do in that 3.5 years, so that he would expect or anticipate that many events would be shaped around him in order to fulfill everything in that short time, because there are several things that had to be done. So he saw her as something unusual approaching. And then telling her this. Now when she said, "Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet," I think she said that with not just that way that I'm saying. She would say it with awe. Because anybody to be talk to you and say that you had had previously 5 husbands, and now you're living with a man who's not your husband, and so forth, you wouldn't just say, "Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet," in that way. No, you would have some emotion in it. And
to make her aware that she...
"Oh, sir, I perceive thou art a prophet," you know, or something like that, not this other cold reply, which is a reading when we read. And that's why this low-key method that the Bible perceives is designed not to attract those who are given to demonstrativeness by nature, or curious, just to have certain input. But it is there, and it's to be tapped and to be realized, because it is there. It's not an imagined thing. It'd be very difficult for me to see this as a cold statement, conversation, a dialectical discussion on just a purely theoretical terms. Oh no, there's emotion and drama in this, but it's overlooked. And that by not putting these embellishments in, the Lord does not want to attract everybody. Because wouldn't a lot of people be interested in the truth if they knew all these things? I mean, they'd be, they'd say, "Why, they're gets on. This is terrific. This is terrific information. And here we had this all along, didn't know it was there. In any event, he knows this and tells her. And now she's turning this into a religious discussion. Notice, she's, I don't think she's too happy to him to delve any further, necessarily, you know, into her secret life. But she perceives now he's like a seer or a prophet of the Old Testament, therefore he's a holy man, he's religious. So she switches the conversation to things pertaining to worship. And but this other is there. She's been touched to the quick, even though this conversation is changing. And did we read 20?
No.
Let's read 20 through 24. Yes. Well, when she, you mean that when she says, "Sir, I perceive," that's an acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. There are several things we'll have to review a little bit until we get the story, but we want to discuss these as we go along a little bit because it helps us to retain it in memory and then go back and review it as a whole. Let's read 20 through 4.
Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is a place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship ye know not what. We know what we worship. Our salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
All right, there's, of course, a lot of things here that some of it we have to go into sort of like a theoretical aspect, and then later think of the whole incident like. Now she's calling to attention that the Samaritans reverenced Mount Gerizim, which is right next to this well, practically, just a quarter of a mile or half a mile, and where, to the Jew, Jerusalem was the center of worship. To the Samaritan, this was the place of worship, where Jacob well was on this mountain. Now, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, Samaria. Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. What time is he talking?
At the end of the age?
Or after the kingdom?
After Pentecost, after the apostles are going to tell them. But, of course, it's limited. That was in David, after Jesus.
That's when you see the city encompassed with armies. Let him that's in Judea flee to the mountains.
If they did it, and maybe the roundabout also was destroyed.
Actually, this is a very deep statement, very, very far-reaching. tremendous depth. I mean, it's just, it's an ongoing thing, what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And it reaches far into the future, far in the future.
Well,
yes.
Frankly, if I could connect with the well, the living water, would that be during the kingdom age?
And
but he says the hour cometh and now is. So he is starting it.
It's a progressive, ongoing thing beyond the millennial age. After the millennial age is finished and you're way beyond it, there will come a time where Jerusalem and all is of no consequence, but not during the kingdom. Because during the kingdom, they have to, at the Feast of Tabernacles, whosoever doeth not come up and worship it, even though it doesn't mean every individual of earth has to go up there, yet representatively they have to recognize that as a center attraction during the kingdom age. And where beyond the kingdom age, you'll still have the city of Jerusalem, you'll still have a temple, but it will not have the same significance that it has during the kingdom age, where let us go up to the house of Judah and so forth, for and he will teach us of his ways. There are many scriptures that indicate that it will be a center of education. But when everybody is brought into perfect harmony with God and considered worthy of everlasting life, they will not need any further education as far as the moral precepts of God and bringing their characters into harmony with it. That has been a finished work. So it's an ongoing thing reaching way, way into the future. And now, when we consider the gospel age application, it's the same principle. When it started in Israel. And Jerusalem did become a center of attraction before AD 69. Well, it was recognized early in the gospel age. But then when that city was destroyed after AD 69, well, then it lost its significance, and they were dispersed into other foreign countries, and then comes the gospel age, the Middle Ages, and so forth. Why? That's all forgotten. So you have the same principle of some recognition being given to Jerusalem early in the Christian dispensation, but later forsaken, and the worship of the Spirit becomes paramount. And the same thing with regard to the kingdom age. There's a period of time in which Jerusalem is a center of attraction, like a capital of the world, as it were. But then, as you go into the ages beyond the kingdom, it begins to lose its significance in that sense. And they look up to the center of the universe more as the center of attraction. So it's an ongoing, progressive matter. But all this is stated in one little short part of a sentence. The hour cometh when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit. They that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. This woman must have been an unusual woman to give this type of a sermon to. This is quite a sermon, as short as it is. I believe it was pretty short here. Now, it was not like the Mount of Beatitudes or somewhere there's hours involved and the disciples come and interrupt this. Comes to a halt. I think in this case it was rather relatively short, and there would be psychological factors too. If she wants to run back and tell the town people, you know, before he gets away, you know, about this man.
And
yes.
We could assume that she had a sinful past, but surely not five husbands died on. But yet, the heart condition.
Yes, that when I say unusual, I mean in the sense that she would be the recipient of such a profound lesson. And here it's a one-on-one, where he spoke to multitudes, or to his disciples. Plural. These are all plural occasions, but here's a private conversation. Nicodemus came to Jesus by night, and that was a private audience, which... And it's interesting that John records these. See, John was a very sensitive man, and he would then dwell on certain subjects that the others overlooked. And they no doubt were aware of these things, but not as deeply as John was impressed. Let's read a little more to finish this account. 25 through 30. Next.
The woman said unto him, I know the Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When he is come, he will tell us all things. Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. And upon this came his disciples, and marvel that he talked with the woman. Yet no man saith, what speakest thou, or why talkest thou with her? The woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city, and saith to the men, come, see a man which told me all things that ever I did. Is not this the Christ? Then they went out of the city and came unto him.
Yes.
He's been a harlot, right?
Yes.
Isn't it rather unusual that Jesus is not really revealing his identity? This is early in his ministry, even to his apostles, seeing Peter came later, and yet he was telling the Samaritan.
That's what I'm saying. That to this particular woman to address these remarks is very significant. Because it's a private conversation, and yet very, very deep, very, very comprehensive in certain aspects in the potential that is in these words. And I that speak unto thee am he. Why, that was my way. You know, if you have that experience and then to think of it. My goodness, you'd want to jump up and think, what an honor, what a privilege. She wanted to share it with some of the townspeople that she knew right away that day. In other words, she realized this is too valuable, this information, for just her. And then psychologically, it was brought to her in because the other disciples are now, just as the conversation was at this point, they come in, back with the food from the town. And this is just the right time when it should have been terminated. He spoke enough to her in this brief conversation, and she did not stay there and wanted to learn more, and that she just felt he was too important to let him go. Mm-hmm. And they came, the townspeople now come to him. Now, had she delayed and had satisfied herself, and he might have stepped up and started walking on his journey. But she saw that here the men are coming with the food. They're going to eat. They'll be here a little while. And if he's going to be here a little while, I've got to go back and get somebody, you know, to come out here, to get them to come out. And she could share then when they would come. Otherwise, to just satisfy herself on this particular matter, an opportunity might have been missed that she would have liked other people to know. Yes.
And she left the water pot. That was in the comfort place.
Yeah.
Run.
Right. Right.
She must have really had the right heart attitude, yeah. And Jesus could see that.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little innocent, I shouldn't, but I think they all knew the woman in town for her past.
Yeah.
And if he could tell
I would suppose, so that it was worth listening to.
You could tell that. That's why I'm saying the fact of Jesus' resurrection would so enthuse and vitalize those who were aware of it at that time that their very words would be like inspirational to others because of the oomph that's in, attached to it, and here the freshness of that conversation carrying that back into the town to the townspeople, they would be impressed that they would be wondering, who is this one that has created this remarkable change in this woman, the Samaritan woman. And this created like a seed bed to be later grown, because then after Jesus' death, his ministry and death and resurrection, and then the apostles would come to this town, go to Jerusalem first, then to Judea, and then unto the Samaritans. So eventually they came unto the Samaritans. We have Philip the evangelist had headquarters there, incidentally, which we come to shortly. Then they would hear of the fact of the Messiah. They would hear probably of his crucifixion too, see. But when they would hear of the resurrection, and then there would be some come and testify to it, that would enkindle their faith and so forth, so that they would respond. So there was a providence back of this whole incident that Jesus properly realized at the time that it occurred, that this was no ordinary woman, in spite of her past. Any other comments? And she addressed him as sir both occasions, you know, in a minute. Sir, why do you ask me for a drink? And then, sir, give me this water. So there was a mark of respect and decorum towards.
And also, do you suppose, realizing her sinful nature, that most would have avoided her and not asked, and that she's kind of moved by this fact that this party is like bypassing it all and asking for water from her in her position with such a background?
Well, I think that. See, it takes time for this to sink in, because when she originally asked all that, she didn't know about his telling him later about her private life. But weighing the whole circumstance and going in and telling the people about he told about all my past life, that impressed him, so that she then would realize that the water he'd have, whatever kind of water that was, he was telling the truth, but still didn't know too much. You know, he didn't explain. And this about the that salvation is of the Jew, not of the Samaritan mountain. But yet, even that is going to be done away with, and it's going to be a different relationship with the Heavenly Father, that all who worship God in spirit and truth, whether it's the Gospel Age or whether it's the Millennial Age, eventually, sometime, will be weaned away from the natural aspect to the spiritual in their worship.
The fact that he, in verse 14, called it a well of water springing up into everlasting life, a well is a source of water. Isn't the implication here really more than just everlasting life? This was, he's really referring to the call of the church, that they would have that immortality that would be the source of.
Well, there's probably several lessons. I mean, it's very profound. For one thing, a well may be a source, but what happens, you have to do effort. Because the woman said, sir, give me of that water, that I might not never thirst again, that's one thing, and that I might never have to come here again. This took effort to get the well, and that's true in this age. To get the truth, even after you have the truth, there's still, for silver and gold, you have to dig. For a well, you have to search or plummet or let down the rope to bring it up. But as far as we're concerned, but then if we're faithful, then where you become a source of water to others, that's, of course, another calling in the next age. They will not have, the stones will be removed and so forth, and everything will be made available to them as to how they react. That's another matter. Yes?
The Samaritans. Now, I have such a shallow understanding of these other nations. I was under the assumption that they worshipped other gods, but here they're in expectation of Messiah too.
Yes.
You know that not.
What the Jews resented about the Samaritans is they considered them as foreigners that originally were placed in the land from an extraneous or Gentile source. And now we're residents there. But what had happened as time went on, there was marriages that took place between Jews and Samaritans. Even though there's some people shunned them, nevertheless, as the time would go on, a few centuries, there would be inroads made. And the Samaritans liked the Jewish religion, but they liked the Jacobean aspect of it. They knew that Jacob, having bought that parcel of land in that particular area, they would regard him like we regard Abraham, as the father of faith. They looked to Jacob as that. And another thing, Jacob had a background too, at Padan Aram, background that is also involved, that they would be aware of which we would have a very limited understanding. Especially have to be a little familiar with the Old Testament with regard to the account to appreciate that aspect. So they would have an affinity to the Jewish religion, but on their terms. And the Jews would be very, very upset. They consider this as like half-breeds. They're not. They're a mixture, an unholy mixture, and that they shouldn't have it, and would bring about an antipathy in that relationship. Between both parties. But the Samaritans, of course, would realize that those that are honest at heart would realize that there's more to this. Because Jacob had a father, his father had a father, and I mean, the thinking Samaritan would have, some of them, a slightly inferiority complex in proportion as they became knowledgeable of the religion of Judea. Well, that's a remarkable thing. And here's a miraculous aspect. We've mentioned about Nicodemus, the miraculous aspect, he prophesied of his being on the cross. That's a delayed reaction, and it struck home to Nicodemus later in his life. When at the time. Here, it's an instantaneous thing. It's in the conversation. So his dealings with a one-on-one basis, whether it was to Zacchaeus, who secretly climbed up in the tree and he looked up and said, Zacchaeus by name. Zacchaeus, I'm having supper with you tonight. Peter, thou shalt be called Peter. Thou art Simon, son of Jonah. Thou shalt be called Peter. A delayed bomb, as it were, that would later energize and have a very conducive effect. So in these one-on-one conversations, it was just fraught with not only explanations and things, but having a personal aspect that they would realize that something miraculous has entered one's life. And that's what we have to be assured of when we consecrate, that this is the real thing, that we're not, that we haven't been mesmerized into some strange teaching that may or may not be true. but it sounds good, and so forth. No, it has to be something that you you realize that this, that he indeed is the Messiah, and so forth, that this is needed as a basis, so that in later life, in periods of discouragement and loneliness, that you could turn and look back and see various landmarks where you know that God has dealt with you in your experiences. And then, as you come to your present status or strange experience that you're having, that, well, if he's led all these steps, then it must be that it's true now in this hard experience that we might be having at a particular moment. So those past experiences are invaluable to for faith. Can we conclude the study? If so,